Good afternoon, everyone. This is Dr. Morgan Sammons, Executive Officer of the National Register. Before we get started, I'd like to welcome my co-moderator for today's presentation, Dr. Jana Martin. Dr. Martin is the CEO of The Trust, the nation's leading provider of professional liability insurance for psychologists. As most of you know, The Register and The Trust recently formed a partnership to deliver high-quality educational content to psychologists. Today's presentation is entitled Role Conflicts and Emotional Support Animal Certifications. Our featured presenter is Dr. Jeff Youngren, a clinical and forensic psychologist and a member of the Trust Risk Management Team. Without further ado, I'm happy to turn it over to Dr. Martin.
Thank you, Morgan. I'm Jana Martin, CEO of the Trust. We are extremely pleased to partner with the National Register and look forward to combining our resources and expertise to positively impact Trust Insureds, National Register members, and the wider community of psychologists. I'm very excited to introduce our featured speaker. A fellow of the American Psychological Association and a distinguished member of the National Academies of Practice, Dr. Youngren is a clinical and forensic psychologist who practices in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and in Rolling Hills Estates, California. He was a clinical professor at the University of California, Los Angeles School of Medicine, and currently is professor in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at the University of New Mexico. Dr. Youngren served as president of APA Division 42, Psychologists in Independent Practice. He has served on numerous boards and committees, including the ethics committees of the California Psychological Association and the American Psychological Association, the APA Committee on Accreditation, and the APA-APLS committee that drafted the specialty guidelines for forensic psychology. Dr. Youngren consults to various licensing boards on ethics and standards of care and qualifies as an expert in criminal, civil, and administrative proceedings. For many years before deciding to travel less, he was a favored ethics presenter for the Trust Professional Liability Insurance Program for Psychologists. Dr. Youngren has been a member of our risk management team at the Trust for over 20 years. As many of you know, a significant benefit of being a Trust policyholder is access to free confidential consultation from our risk management consultants. Dr. Youngren is one of seven experts with clinical and extensive legal training who are on the Trust Risk Management Team and provide guidance on a number of issues such as requests for records, HIPAA compliance, informed consent, telepsychology, and difficult clinical issues. The Trust Risk Management Team will also be presenting at the November National Practice Conference. Today, you're in for a treat. Dr. Youngren never disappoints. Dr. Youngren, turning it over to you.
Well, thank you, Jana, and thanks, Morgan. It's a pleasure to do this and welcome everyone who's going to weather this 45-50-minute talk with me in addressing what I think is an extremely important topic, one that has garnered a lot of attention nationally. Something that we really need to discuss as fellow professionals about how to deal with emotional support animal requests and what goes into the proper certification of a patient or of an individual for that kind of a letter for the presence of an emotional support animal regardless. So we're kind of review that. I think the slide you're looking at right now shows that I don't have any conflict of interest. So there are no conflicts of interest. I probably have conflicts, but no conflicts of interest. And so, and this slide that I'm showing you now is an extremely important slide. The discussion of emotional support animals and the certification of emotional support animals and the appropriate professional conduct wrapped around those certifications has nothing to do with liking or not liking animals, pets, dogs. It has to do with standards of professional practice. It has to do with law. It has to do with exposure, and it has to do with negligence. So we're not talking about whether individuals do or don't like dogs or shouldn't like cats. It really has nothing to do with what the focus of this is about. So we have a number of objectives here that really come out of research and publications that I and my colleagues, Cassie Bonas and others, have worked on for a number of years because we became aware of the problems with these certifications. So we want to talk a little bit about role conflicts that exist when treating psychologists or treating mental health professionals actually do these certifications. We want to make sure that you who are listening have some understanding about what ESAs can do and can't do under the law, because there's a big vacuum there in terms of that. We really want to discuss what ethically you should do when you're considering making an ESA determination. You need to also deal with what should be evaluated as a part of an adequate ESA needs assessment. And then the last one, which is maybe the most important, but maybe they're all important, analyze how the current disability laws impact ESA certifications and ESA as an initialism for emotional support animals, and the potential long-term impact of these types of certifications on the clients and patients that you provide these letters to. So hopefully we'll get through all of those. I'm trying to keep track of the time as I talk to you all about this. This is our first publication. We have a second publication in OAS in professional psychology. We have a third publication that's currently under review in this area. This is the one that Cassie Bonas did and Jennifer Bosford did, which we raised the issues about the role conflicts that we're going to address today. So let's talk a little bit about the language of this area. Well, the first question or issue is that a service animal is a different beast under the law from an emotional support animal. They are not the same. And and when individuals are talking about service animals and get them mixed up with the emotional support animals, we run into a lot of difficulties, because what service animals can do under the law are just entirely different things than what an emotional support animal can do under the law. And mixing up those initialisms and the names is a serious problem. Under the law, under the ADA, a service animal is limited to a dog and a miniature horse. That's it. Not a cat, not any other kind of animal, which under the law is not a pet. It's a working animal that has been trained to provide a direct disability-related benefit. So this animal must be trained, and it is certified vis-a-vis that training to provide disability-related benefits directly to that individual, whether that is vision impairment, emotional problems, whatever that is. This is a service animals have a much wider accommodation under the law. They can go places that emotional support animals simply cannot go, like restaurants or like dormitory common meeting areas, because they provide the accommodation to the individual with that disability. Vastly different from the ESA, because under the law, an ESA can be a pet when a service animal isn't even considered a pet. It's considered something that is working to provide a benefit to the disabled individuals. Under the ESA laws, special accommodations, and that's a term out of the law, must be afforded to individuals who need emotional support animals to assist them. But interestingly, ESAs don't require any training that is necessary under the law to certify the animal as an ADA-compliant service animal. So under the law, if an individual is certified to have an emotional support animal, there are special accommodations that are provided for the owner of that animal because of that certification. I've listed one of them there, which is that when one provides a certification for an ESA, then an individual under the Fair Housing Act has to be able to have that animal in their domicile, and that means their room, and cannot be charged a fee that would be charged for a pet waiver, or also they can actually stay in facilities that have no pet rules. So under the ADA, this is a compliance that's consistent with the law. But we have a lot of ESAs in action, and some of this has embarrassed the profession. I have this slide up here, which is kind of funny, but the truth is these are certified emotional support animals because they are not limited to dogs and miniature horses. They're limited to, or unlimited, in terms of the animals that can be provided that certification. So this obviously can be both an embarrassing and a dangerous area of practice. So as I said earlier, under the housing regulations, when someone provides the landlord with a letter of certification for an ESA, they are allowed to have that animal in their room. That meets the legal definition of reasonable accommodation. Now, the term reasonable accommodation doesn't just wrap itself around the landlord. It wraps itself around the animal owner, too. So if the behavior of the animal becomes unreasonable, the landlord does not have to accommodate that animal under the law. So if you have or your patient or client has a dog that defecates in the hallway or is in the common area or is making noise or is a problem in some way or another, that argues against the whole concept of being a reasonable accommodation. And so this obviously then can be a difficulty. But the imposition of a fee or deposit is considered contrary to the purposes of the law. Okay. The second law, the first one is the Fair Housing Act under the ADA. The second law that impacts emotional support animals, and the one that probably gets by far the most attention in the media, is the Air Carrier Access Act, which was written in 2003, and probably not written with much consultation with mental health professionals, because some of the wording is really clearly lawyerly, but not necessarily reflects the understanding of the standards of practice or care for mental health professionals. The quote under the Air Carrier Access Act says that the carrier cannot impose charges for providing facilities, equipment, or services that are required as part of the act and to qualified individuals with a disability. Please note that last word, disability. We're not talking about something that just makes someone uncomfortable. They must have a disability. Then, according to the Department of Transportation, people with a mental health disability can travel with their animal in the main cabin of the airplane if that animal is there for emotional support. So the carriers must provide access to the transportation free of charge to the individual who has and I'll use the term psychiatric because that's the term under the law, who has a psychiatric disability. So certified by the letters that are provided to them by the mental health providers who have conducted the evaluations of the individuals. Passengers who have a disability may have to provide the airline with documentation on the letterhead of the mental health provider, and that documentation reflects the following under the law: that the passenger has a formal mental health disability, related disability, listed in the DSM-4. And I know everyone's going like, well, but we have DSM-5. I'm sorry, the law hasn't changed. So that's still the wording of the law. I'm sure that substituting 5 for 4 is absolutely fine, but that's the way it reads. But the highlighted section is the one that I think is so important, which is that you have to provide a certification verifying that the individual has a mental health disability, that the animal accompanies the passenger, and that animal is necessary, should have highlighted that too, but I didn't, to the passenger's mental health treatment or to assist the passenger. The individual providing the assessment of the passenger has to be a licensed mental health professional. So it's not just psychologists, psychiatrists, licensed professional counselors, social workers, all those individuals who under the law are allowed to provide services to mental health patients or clients are qualified under the law to provide that site of certification. And then the certification has to include the date and the nature of the license and the jurisdiction in which it was issued. So that's right out of the Federal Register. Those are the game rules for providing the necessary information to those individuals who want an ESA. So let's talk about the problems that have surfaced. And these are problems about which we've written in a number of venues and have published it elsewhere. One of the positions I and my co-authors have taken is consistent with work and publications by Greenberg and Schumann in the 90s, there's a significant difference between the role of a forensic functioning or administrative role or a individual who provides assessment services to answer questions about a disability and so forth, and an individual who is treating someone. And the written literature is replete with concerns about why treating professionals should not get involved in providing these kinds of external assessments, because simply they have nothing to do with therapy. If they have something to do with therapy, that's fine. So let me digress a little bit to address that. If as part of a treatment program for an anxiety disorder, you are incorporating the presence of an animal in an active program, that of course is consistent with the role of a clinician. And when that's done, the certification is over, and the individual no longer needs the animal. We are not saying that that is a role conflict. We would say it would become a role conflict if at the end of the treatment, the individual still wants the animal, and you're going to certify that that's okay, because that really basically has nothing to do with therapy. Okay, the second is an extremely important point. These letters are formal determinations that the individual has a mental health disability, has a psychiatric disability. It's a determination of the fact that they have a major impairment in some major life function that with which they struggle. That is different than somebody who has a diagnosis, somebody who has anxiety problems in certain places. This is a determination on your part when you provide these assessments that the individual has a mental health disability, formally said. Okay, what's the third point of concern for us? Well, we looked at the research about the empirical evidence, we're not talking about evidence that would be, I know an individual who had an animal and it worked well for them. We're talking about actual empirical research. That's empirical, but we're talking about group study research. There's not much literature that shows that the animals do anything to address a formal psychiatric disability. The research is inconsistent, and spotty is the term that we've used. So the conclusion that the presence of the animal actually ameliorates the defined disability is a question that's asked beyond what we currently know in terms of the science of mental health or psychology or whatever. We simply don't know what the long-term impact of the presence of the animal is on an individual. Now, I know there are people out there that are probably going like, oh, no, I know that. I'm not talking about somebody who is happier being with their dog or cat. That is not the issue. That's not the issue under the law. The issue under the law is the presence of the animal ameliorates the major, I'll use the term, psychiatric symptomatology related to the disability. That's what the law requires. The next point that's important is that most of the people I know who have provided these kinds of evaluations and who feel that they should be able to do that have very little understanding about what the law says about disability, that disability is a legal term. And so that when you're providing disability evaluations for Social Security or consistent with the Air Carrier Act or for the Fair Housing Act, there are definitions of disability under those laws with which you need to be familiar to make sure that your assessment matches what the requirements of the law happen to be for what a disability is. And I'll use an analogy. Someone comes to you, has some major life problems, they can't go to work. when you disable them at the state level for disability insurance, if you will, there's an actual form that defines the law, what you're saying, how long you can do it, and so it lets you know what is required of you to certify said disability. Now, I'm one of the people that believes that treating therapists shouldn't be doing that very much, and when I practiced clinically, I told individuals that I disabled that I would disable them once or twice, but when we got beyond that, that they would then need their certification of disability to come elsewhere, and that was a result, come from elsewhere, and that was really the result of my experience, was that when I provided disability, then the disability became a problem if I felt the patient no longer needed the disability, but they still wanted it. And so the goal was to move that outside of the treatment setting so we could focus on treatment, which is what we're about. So in an acute way, we provide those disability evaluations. In a long-term, we're dealing with, you know, real long-term and stable or disability as a whole different question, and I believe it's a forensic question. It's not a clinical question. Okay, so disability definitions are quite varied, and frequently the presence of the animal has nothing to do with therapy. That is, the people who are writing these letters for their clients, the letters are just being written because somebody has asked for the presence of the animal from a mental health professional who has never even looked at the law to understand what they're writing the letters for. Or, and most importantly, what the long-term implications of writing that letter may be for the mental health professional who so certifies that there is a disability, much less what the impact of that disability would be on the patient in the long term. And let me give you an example of that. Since these letters are formal determinations of psychiatric disability, they could have long-term implications for the patients or clients who want to get security clearances, work in law enforcement, work in high-stress areas, because those disabilities can interfere with their securing the certifications necessary to do their jobs. But most people writing these letters, frankly, and many of you do know this, but many don't understand the long-term implication or impact of telling the world, if you will, that somebody has a long-term disability that is psychiatrically related. So that's those are clear issues and problems. So what is a disability? And I took this section out of an article that a good colleague in the law world, Richard Hunt, who works out of Dallas, Texas, and deals with Fair Housing Administration problems with emotional support animals. He wrote this article in the National Psychologist. Mr. Hunt is an expert in FHA disability issues and the impact of ESAs on the landlords and so forth. So what is a disability anyway? Well, we run into problems. First, disability is not a mental health concept. It's a legal concept. It has to do with the definition of the law. So you need to understand that when you so certify someone to have a disability, you are making and providing information that has to be consistent with the legal definition of what disability is. The second is, well, that helps us a lot. There are actually 6 federal laws that have differing definitions of what disability is. So when you are providing a disability determination consistent with one of those laws, I think the onus falls upon your shoulders to make sure you understand that definition. That you, if you are providing a Social Security disability evaluation, you need to understand what the definition of disability is under the Social Security Act. Or if you are providing a disability certification for air transportation of the animal as an ESA, you need to know what the definition of disability is under the Air Carrier Access Act. And if you don't, I think that answers close to negligence. Not negligence in the sense that you're going to get disciplined, but it's just not, it's not complete because you don't know what you're providing that certification for. For a mental health professional working with a patient, disability is not just a matter of discomfort. That meaning, you know, I'm a little nervous on the airplane, but I want to have my cat with me because I feel better when the cat is with me. That it does not meet the requirement under the law. It is that the presence of the animal provides a reduction in their major psychiatric and psychological symptoms that interfere with their major life activities. So the animal has to reduce the symptoms that they experience that relate directly with the disability that you have so certified. That is a pretty heady and high-level determination. It's not just a casual thing. And I'll share with you all, I have felt for the last years as I've worked in this area that these should not be done by treating clinicians. It just is a much more complex determination than the treating clinicians really generally understand. Many of you do, and that's fine, but I think the role conflict then becomes a problem. So when you provide the letter, you're really saying that you as a mental health professional have determined professionally that the presence of the animal ameliorates the formal disability that you have evaluated that the patient has, and that that presence of the animal improves the quality of the of an individual's major life activities that were impacted by the disability. That's not just being happy with the dog on your lap. It's much more heady than that. Next one. Okay, so, and under the law, usually, disability means a physical or mental impairment that substantially limits one of the major life activities, and I emphasize that. Obviously, substantially is a word that has a lot of wiggle room. But it isn't close to kinda. It isn't close to better or the kind of improves. It means substantially improves the individual's functioning as it directly relates to the psychiatric disability that you've diagnosed. And again, I'm using the term psychiatric because it refers to DSM-5. And this is right out of Richard's article in the National Psychologist. I will let you all know that all of these references are provided for you, and you're welcome to go to get them on the website. You'll be able to get all these references, as well as a plethora of other references that deal directly with this issue. So Richard wrote in his article, he said, even the emotional support animals, there must be a disability-related need for the animal. A patient with mild depression may feel better when a cat is around, but that does not mean there's a disability-related need for the animal. Then the mental health professional needs to be aware that they're certifying that the patient, and that certification requires a proper diagnosis, an understanding of the law, and I should have highlighted this correct legal definition of disability, because if it doesn't, there is a possibility that the determination could be wrong, and that exposes you legally, because you haven't done what the law requires, but you certified it. Much more complex than most people would think. So the ESA, so what's happened around us? Well, there's an industry now that exists, embarrassingly so, that provides these determinations, and it doesn't reflect well on us as professionals in the mental health field. These are just some links from the past that I put in the presentation, so you can find companies that will certify your animal, your dog, snake, cat, fish, bird, whatever you want, as an emotional support animal. They generally provide online evaluations, and then the certification letters are signed by hungry professionals who don't realize that providing evaluations of individuals they've never seen is actually a violation of the standard of practice. And you go like, oh, Jeff, come on, let's not overstate it. Wrong. There is actually a disciplinary action that occurred in Colorado against a licensed mental health professional who provided these types of certifications without ever interacting directly with the individual who received the letters, and he has subsequently lost his license. So there's this industry for $90, $100, you get your letter. Actually, I think it's malpractice because you don't know if somebody really has a formal disability. What has this done? Well, it's filled our airports with people who really are not disabled, and who are trying to bring their animals on the airplanes for a variety of reasons, some of which have to do with traveling free, some of which have to do with not wanting to leave their animals at home, and all of which have nothing to do with the fact that they've been psychiatrically, psychologically disabled in the first place. The president of United Airlines went on a news conference explaining how some mental health practitioner had actually certified an emotional support animal for an emotional support animal. So we had two animals on the plane, one of which was for the patient, and the other one which was for the animal, so certified as an emotional support animal. I will say to you, my friends, that's utter nonsense. And it reflects very poorly on us when these kinds of things are going on. The result of this has been that the air transport industry is bolting down on this. And you may know that Delta Airlines has now stated that you cannot bring pit bulls on airplanes. You know, we had a veteran that was attacked by an emotional support animal and suffered significant facial scars. We've had dog fights on airplanes. We've had animals defecate and airplanes throw up. We had a variety of somewhat embarrassing things happen. Why? Because these animals are not trained. The law doesn't require that they be trained. And the people who certify them don't really understand what they're doing, and I'll take full responsibility for that. That is my position as a colleague, that these people don't understand the complexity of this. They're going along and providing this, and they're making a mistake, I believe. So, certification of ESAs. We did a little study, and Cassie Bonnes was the first author on this paper, our second paper published in Professional Psychology, where we surveyed mental health professionals and forensics professionals. Didn't get a huge response, 87 responses, enough that we could get some significance from the data, but we wanted to find out whether people had made the recommendation, whether they felt it was appropriate for treating mental health professionals to provide opinions on the need for ESAs, and whether they themselves felt competent about providing these types of determinations. The results came through, interestingly, even with the low N, with some significant results. Questions were, what would you use if you did this kind of assessment? And the clinicians and the forensics very much differed here. While the clinicians were comfortable using things like brief symptom inventory and symptom checklists, things that are commonly part of professional practice, the forensic people were much more prone to wanting to use more traditional forensic instruments to include assessments of malingering, because individuals who have an incentive to get something, whether it's a disability or an ESA, may malinger symptomatology in order to get that. So the results of the study showed that there was a significant split between clinicians and forensic specialists. And then we asked them, have you ever made a forensic a recommendation for an ESA? And the data was kind of stunning. We found out that clinicians, even though we feel that clinicians shouldn't be doing this, had done it far more than the forensics, who we feel should be doing it if we knew how to do it. But the data then conflicted, because the forensics and the clinicians both felt that it was appropriate for a treating mental health professional to offer an opinion. Our belief is that this result really is an artifact of the fact that people don't understand the law, that they really don't understand what these certifications reflect. That my belief is that if they did, these data would be significantly different. And both groups felt they were qualified to make an ESA determination. You point out that difference between clinicians and forensics was significant to 0.01. So significant problems. So what did we find? We found that forensic evaluators who would do ESA determinations actually would use much more complex and forensically consistent instruments to include formal assessments of malingering. While the clinicians make more recommendations, they really felt that one of the problems here was that the people didn't feel competent to do the assessment, because we don't have guidelines about how to do assessments. So It's kind of an interesting thing in medicine. If, you know, something, you know, there aren't standards on how to do something, medicine generally tries to be more conservative about that. But in the world of ESA assessment, it seems like we're dealing with the opposite, which is that we lack standards, we lack research, we don't know really what the long-term effects of this would be, but regardless, we're still going ahead and doing it. It's a matter of substantial concern for the profession. Okay, so what are the ethical issues and concerns that you should be aware of when someone comes in and asks you to write an ESA letter for them? Well, the first one I talked about is the role conflict issue, that I believe that the role of a clinician is simply incompatible with writing that letter, generally. Not always. If it's a part of the treatment, I would be different on that. But when you write that letter, I'll ask you, what does that letter have to do with treatment? It's kind of like writing a letter for a lawyer. What does that have to do with treatment? And for those of you that are uncomfortable with that, I invite you to read Greenberg and Schumann's 90s article, a very cited article in the forensic literature about these role conflicts. The next issue, which is a really important issue, is competence. We don't even know how to do these assessments. So for that, we need to be really conservative. If we are going to say that we can provide the assessments in areas where there's not a lot of research, where the standards of conduct are unclear, that we really need to be very conservative and not liberal and ask ourselves the question, am I competent enough to answer the question that this patient person needs a letter of emotional support determination? Do I know how to do that? Do I know the impact of that? Do I know what the law requires? Do I know what instruments I might use? Really, I think good questions that need to be answered by every clinician who is asked to provide the letter. Is there a risk to the therapeutic alliance? And there is a risk to the therapeutic alliance. What if you provide a letter for a client of yours, and then 3 months down the road, you feel that the client doesn't need that animal anymore? What are you going to do if the client wants that animal for a variety of maybe not even mental health related issues, and you feel it's not necessary? Because of the role conflict, the first bullet that you have there, you have created a risk to the therapeutic alliance, because that's created an unnecessary conflict. Because really, the animal didn't have much to do with therapy. It just had to do with the client saying that they are happier with the animal, which is fine. There's nothing wrong with that. But the issue for you as the competent, the second bullet, mental health professional, is you know the animal has to ameliorate major psychological symptoms related to the disability. That's a requirement of the law. And if you continue to provide the letter for an individual who doesn't need that, that's an act of negligence on your part. So it risks the therapeutic alliance. The other thing is that objectivity. Pardon me, I'm sorry, I'm coughing. Research has shown over and over from a variety of venues that treating therapists are advocates for their patients. And that's great, because that's necessary to really successfully treat someone. But that objectivity may be called into question when you agree to write a letter for a client of yours for an evaluation of which you're unclear, for a legal standard with which you are unfamiliar, with long-term potential consequences that you really are missing because you're an advocate, which you should be. Determinations like this, or like other administrative determinations, call for a higher level of objectivity that really has to exist usually outside of the therapeutic alliance. And so your objectivity gets kind of called into question because you're an advocate for your client and for the individual for whom you wrote the letter. And the last one, thoroughness. What have you done to support the fact that you did a formal evaluation of an individual and arrived at a formal determination that they have a disability that requires a formal intervention, which is the presence of the animal, to ameliorate that disability? And what do you know about whether that animal does actually do any of that? Or is it that you are just taking the word of an individual that that happens? And I'm not interested in scaring people, but could you defend that in court? Could you? Could you convince a legal tribunal that you were thorough in this determination? And why do I ask you that? Because there are some risks here, as Mr. Hahn pointed out in his article to you, if you don't provide an adequate assessment of the individual consistent with the law. And what about vicarious liability? Well, let me show you this slide. This is a young lady who was at the Oregon airport and a owner of an ESA that happened to be a pit bull was there. And the little girl wanted to go over and pet the animal. And the owner of the animal said, fine. And the mother let the little girl go over to pet the animal, and the end result is what you're looking at, which, by the way, is far worse, and it really is because some of the injuries are actually grayed out on that picture. What's the risk to a mental health professional who provided that certification that that animal should be on the plane? Is there a vicarious liability that could chase its way back to you if you haven't done an adequate assessment of the individual to include an assessment of the animal? Is there a chance that in the forum of legal argument, you might not be able to prove the fact that you were as thorough as you should be, and the end result are injuries that are, you know, lifelong? So if you're going to do this, I think most of you would agree, we need to be thorough. We need to do it right. We're lacking in standards and guidance. We need to be more thorough, not less. We need to be more objective, not less, to make sure that we protect those people that we treat, that we meet the definitions of the law, and we don't end up finding ourselves in a courtroom arguing that we thought we did a good job when, in fact, we didn't. So that drove those questions that I addressed just a minute ago, drove a recent article that we have submitted for review. I anticipate that it will be accepted. We prepared a model for how these evaluations should occur and what needs to go into the proper assessment of the need for an emotional support animal, because we need these standards. There's no question we need some guidance. You know, how do you do it? And you say, well, Jeff, you're saying we shouldn't do it. Well, how do you do it if somebody does need it? I think there's a way you can do it. I think that there is an area where this is necessary and important. The first thing we want to make sure happens, and this is the essence of our article, is that you have done a disability evaluation consistent with the existing definitions and laws of disability. That is, you know what the disability requirement is under the Fair Housing Act and under the Air Carrier Access Act. You know what they need. You could argue that the disability definition meets the evaluation you've done of your client. The second thing we believe is that you have to know the laws. How can you write a letter for a special accommodation for an individual when you don't even understand what the law says? I don't know how you can do that. Now, you can learn the laws. I learned the laws. My co-authors have learned the laws. It's actually, there are not a ton of them, but they're there, and you should read them. If you're going to do ESA evaluations, you need to understand the law. Now, this is the area that I think is creative, and we pat ourselves on the back for this one. An evaluation of the animal's ability to perform the function consistent with the animal's abilities and temperament. Most mental health professionals are not qualified to evaluate animals. There are individuals who can do that. So that if you're going to certify that someone needs an emotional support animal, we are suggesting that that animal be evaluated for its ability to actually provide that service. Not to be overwhelmed in an airport where they're on a leash with tons of people, terrified with a bunch of unfamiliar individuals around, and then prone to behavior that's inconsistent with what the goal of the certification is. We really believe that there is a way to evaluate whether the animal can even provide that, and this article will discuss that. Some psychologists are probably qualified to do that, but most psychologists wouldn't be. Veterinarians or animal behaviorists could do that. And then the last one was an interaction that you evaluate of the animal with the client. How can we determine that the animal ameliorates the symptoms of a disorder if we never see the animal with the patient or client or with the evaluee? I don't know how you can do that. I mean, I understand the patient might tell you it works, but we recommend that the evaluation include an actual formal observation of the interaction of the animal with the owner to support the claim that the animal's presence ameliorates the problems. Those are our publications. There's a much more comprehensive list of references related to ADA and FHA and the Air Carrier Act, which will be available to you. These are our two publications. Hopefully we'll get the review over in the next one and get it out within the next few months, but it is suffering the comfort of reviewers. We're not getting it done as fast as we'd like, but we'll get it done. So that is the end of my little talk. So I'm happy to entertain questions, Morgan.
Jeff, we have literally over 100 very, very thoughtful questions that your conversation has brought up, and there's no way I can get to all of them. I want to first thank you for your very, very informative presentation. I really like that summary slide where you said, hey, this is not something that you are absolutely prohibited from doing, but please, if you are going to write one of these letters, you must take these factors into consideration when you do so. And I think that that alone will help us push the standards for writing these letters and credentialing writing these letters and certifying them. That will push us forward quite a bit. But that also touched on probably the most common theme that I was able to glean from the many questions that came in. And that's the tension that most of the listeners or many listeners had between, hey, I'm in treatment with this patient. I want to help this patient out. I understand that there may be some other considerations, but many times these people are not available. Where can I find a forensic psychologist? Perhaps more importantly, to your last point, where can I find an animal behaviorist who can answer those very important questions? Could you spend a few minutes talking about those points?
Yeah, I'm happy to do that. The focus of my talk is not just to clinicians, but to forensic people as well. We need to help everyone learn how to do this better, and we're moving towards that. I mean, I would tell you that having that evaluation even done by a clinician who has no relationship with you is better than having you do the evaluation when you have the challenge of being an advocate for the client, potential risk of the therapeutic relationship. I think it would be much safer for you to say, I'm going to refer you to my colleague X, who's going to evaluate whether this is the appropriate thing to do, and then X should know how to do this. That's all important, and I think, Morgan, that's consistent with that last slide, is that the questions that are answered need to be answered from that list of four. And I have no fantasy that psychologists, social workers, psychiatrists have to be experts in animal behavior. But I think it's fair to ask the client to have a vet certified that the animal is safe. I think, and by the way, I don't think the vet would be very prone to do that, but I think that you could take them to a dog trainer, individuals who actually do certifications for service animals, to see whether this animal can be exposed to the situation that you're going to expose them in. It's not just the emotional well-being of the individual that we're talking about. It's the emotional well-being of the animal. I fly, 130,000 miles a year. I see these animals frequently. They're overwhelmed in that environment. So finding somebody external, a dog trainer, somebody to certify that this animal actually can provide the function that is alleged to be provided. And then I really am a believer, and I'm happy to talk with my colleagues about that. How can you evaluate if you haven't seen the client with the animal? You need to see whether the animal actually does anything. And I think that that gets us closer to an existing standard.
You know, I think that that's a very good point, and I'm glad you raised it. You know, flying quite a bit myself and looking at the distress of some of these animals, that is maybe a factor that many folks who write ESA letters don't consider when writing that letter. And that brings me to a point that several listeners brought up, and I think it's a good one, although I'm not sure that there's a ready answer to it. What about if you encounter a patient for whom a previous provider has written a letter for an ESA, and then the patient wants to do something like, say, bring the emotional support animal to a crowded waiting room for an appointment with you? How then do we go, and a similar question, of course, would be, what if you encounter these, I'll call them for what I think they are, unethical online mass producers of ESA letters? What if you encounter patients or others who have gotten one such letter? What is our responsibility, ethical and otherwise, to say, maybe this isn't an appropriate thing for you to be doing, or maybe this is actually causing harm to you or the animal or those around you? How do you respond?
That's a fabulous question. And my answer, not being glib, is tell the truth. Tell the truth that somebody has created a state of affairs where they have this ESA letter. You know it wasn't done well. You don't know the area at all. And then you need to tell the client that this is not an area within which I function. I don't provide these kinds of assessments. But I can tell you this, that the one you have is inconsistent with the standard of practice, that I would never do that. And I think that the online's I think you can go on and on, that the online evaluations are inadequate assessment.
I think we all agree with that, that providing these via online assessments is clearly not something that we as ethical practicing psychologists would do. Are there legal...
Can I mention something? I didn't mean to interrupt.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to cut you off.
Mr. Hunt logged in with a comment, and he's, of course, the attorney that works with Fair Housing. I don't know if you saw that. Did you...
I did not. I've missed it. So please go ahead.
Well, let me see if I can bring it back. He said, I advise my clients who are asked for an accommodation to do an animal interview before granting it. If the animal can't behave around a strange leasing agent, it probably isn't going to work in an apartment complex or dorm. So, you know, bring the animal in. Take a look at whether the animal can actually do this. And also, Morgan, ESAs are not allowed to go everywhere. Actually, you don't have to let that animal come into your waiting room. That has nothing to do with the Fair Housing Act. The Fair Housing Act is defined clearly. The animal can be in your apartment. It is not allowed to roam around the common area. It can enter and leave the building. It has to have a defined area within which to defecate and urinate, and that's it. They don't get to go to classrooms. They don't get to go to restaurants. They don't get to go to the shopping center. That is not a part of the law. What that reflects is a lack of understanding of the law. And that's not in the best interest of anybody.
Yeah, that's an important point. We had several questions about students with requests for ESAs in dorms, for example.
They can be in the rooms. But the student is responsible for taking care of the animal, cleaning up after the animal. If that student doesn't clean up after the animal, the university can remove the accommodation because you're not allowed to impose upon the process. Yes, you're allowed to have the animal in the room at a place you're defecated. The animal has to be on a leash. You're going to do it. I've said a lot about our colleagues needing to understand the law.
The clients
need to understand the law.
And helping patients or clients understand that law, I think, is key to having a good therapeutic relationship and doing the right thing for the patient and everyone else. So Jeff, we're out of time. I want to thank you once again for a really fabulous presentation. The comments coming in have been very, very positive, and I learned a great deal from this webinar today. So thank you once again.